Welcome to the 120th episode of the Reading and Writing Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Rutherford. Stay tuned for my interview with horror writer Brian Easton, author of the novel Autobiography of a Werewolf Hunter. Stay tuned for the interview. Welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. My guest today is Brian Easton, author of Autobiography of a Werewolf Hunter and Heart of Scars, the second book of Autobiography of a Werewolf Hunter. Brian, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thanks a lot for having me, Jeff.
Sure. Well, first I wanted to see if you could read the first page or two of the prologue of Autobiography of a Werewolf Hunter.
Sure, my pleasure. When I was 12, I couldn't wait to be a man. And I thought I'd be one when I turned 13. That meant everything to a boy who, more than anything, wanted to be like his papa. What I wanted was to make him proud of me because I'd had caused him so much grief. I thought if I did everything right, I could make it up to him. My father's name was Foster James, and he was French-Canadian. He met my mother, Abigail, in Nova Scotia, where they married and settled after World War II. Mother was half Cheyenne Indian. I was born in Halifax in 1950, and it was the nurses who named me Sylvester Logan. They said they couldn't stop my mother's bleeding. I don't think she ever got to hold me. We lived in an old house in Lethbridge, Alberta, near where Mama had grown up. Her parents were gone, and Papa's had died when he was young, so we only had each other. Papa had been a woodsman most of his life. He said it ran in his blood. From being with him, I learned to read the forest's secret language of sight and sound. The time we spent in the woods together was the finest I remember. We'd find tracks in the snow or mud, and he'd quiz me on which animal had made them. Or he'd point to a tree and say, "I wish I knew what kind of tree that is," which was my cue to provide the answer. He taught me to fish in the summer, to hunt in the autumn, and to trap in the winter. I always believed that Papa held me responsible for Mama's death. There were times he would look at me like I was a ghost, and when I would ask him what was wrong, he would force a sad smile and shake his head. But most of the time, he just stared through me, and I could almost read his mind. "I know you," he seemed to say. "You're the one who killed my wife." I always felt ashamed. I don't remember ever hearing Papa laugh. But he didn't cry, either. Real men didn't do such things. He believed tears were a sign of a weak spirit, and there was no place in my father's life for weakness. When I would cry, he would be stern and tell me to let it turn to something else. I suppose it was his way of dealing with pain, a mental exercise that changed weak emotions into strong ones. It also turned tears into anger. Every year, Papa took me rabbit hunting with my black Labrador, Brutus. The autumn of my 9th birthday, the three of us had found an area where loggers had left piles of dried brush and dead limbs, just the sort of places rabbits like to hide. Brutus flushed three from a particular pile, and Papa sent the first one rolling. I trained the bead of my 410 shotgun on the second, but as I tightened against the trigger, Brutus bolted into my line of fire. He yelped and tumbled into a heap. I rushed to him and dropped to the ground. His blood leaked onto my trousers as I held him. His eyes looked so surprised before he wilted in my arms. I buried my face in his neck and sobbed, "I'm sorry, Brutus." Papa kneeled behind me and placed his hand on my shoulder. "Crying won't bring him back," he said. "Turn it to something else. Turn it to something else, boy. Tears don't help anyone." I tried to do what he said, like he taught me, but all I could think of was that I had killed my dog, just like I'd killed my mama. Papa's hand tightened as he pulled me away from the dog. I clung to him and I cried, but he just patted me on the back. Then he held me at arm's length. "Look at me, Sylvester," he demanded. "Real men don't cry. If you want to be a real man, then let it turn to something else. Turn it toward the rabbits. Do you understand?" For the next 2 years, whenever I hunted rabbits, I didn't do it for the sport or for food. It was a vendetta. I wanted them dead because they'd made me kill my dog, and there was a cold sense of retribution every time I pulled the trigger.
Great. Well, if someone listening hasn't heard about your autobiography of a werewolf hunter novels yet, how would you describe the novels?
Well, the novels are a departure from typical werewolf fare, I think, in the fact that they focus on a human being rather than the monsters themselves. We see a lot today with werewolves and vampires and very monster-centric television and books and movies, and these things are great. I love them. But my books take a road away from that by dealing with what I think is a true human emotion, the human condition, if you will. And it kind of explores what it would take to make a man who essentially wants to be a good and decent human being and basically ruin that for him with hatred.
Gotcha. And do you remember how you first got the idea for Sylvester James, the werewolf hunter, in your novels?
Well, you know, that's a question that doesn't have a one answer. He is the child of several different inspirations, some as ridiculous as an episode of Laverne and Shirley in 1977, and others from a youthful fascination with comic book monster hunters like Marvel's Blade the Vampire Slayer. I'd noticed that there didn't seem to be too many werewolf hunters around. In fact, I didn't find any short of Lon Chaney, Claude Rains, and a silver-handled stick in the Wolfman. So I decided to kind of fill the gap with a comic book character when I was probably 10 years old, and he eventually became Sylvester Logan James.
Gotcha. So what is it about the werewolf monster that appeals or interests you as a writer? Or, as you mentioned earlier, is it more about the hunter?
Well, it is about the hunter, but, you know, the hunter is not much without his prey. And the werewolf, you know, even though he's not the central point of the book, he is obviously the catalyst by which all these things happen. Werewolves have been my favorite monster, if you want to put it that way, since I was a kid. I don't know. I think it's came from something as simple as, you know, whose monster can beat up whose monster. I used to, you know, grew up as a big fan of the Universal classics, like a lot of kids did back then. And I liked the Creature from the Black Lagoon because he was so, you know, completely powerful in the water. And I loved Frankenstein because he was unstoppable. But there was something about the werewolf, something about just that innate savagery of the beast that I thought could take out any of them. I thought, you know, maybe the only good fight might be between it and the creature, but only in the water. And that was probably my first turn on, I guess, towards the werewolf, and the fact that I thought it was just the baddest ass monster on the block. And I still pretty much think so. But as I got older, you know, and started investigating werewolf myths in both history and mythology, I began to find a lot of other aspects about it, occult aspects that really inspired me.
Sure. I'm curious if you've read a lot of other werewolf literature and if there are particular books that stand out for you that you may have read.
I have read quite a bit of factual, if we can use that term, treatment on the subject that is nonfiction. I haven't read just a lot of werewolf fiction. I've read maybe a handful of novels,
right?
But the ones that really stand out to me as for being important could be Montague Summers' The Werewolf, Montague Summers as whatever people may think of him, was an encyclopedia of knowledge on the occult, and his representation of the werewolf and his kind of ideas about the werewolf as being, you know, servants of the devil and these kinds of things are at the very heart of my concept of the beast, as I refer to it in the books. So those kinds of books, the ones written by occultists or by people who are giving it more of a socio-anthropological study have done more to influence my opinions and my work on the subject than any fiction ever did.
Right, right. What was your background prior to having your first novel published? What was the path to publication like for you?
Well, I've been writing since I was 10 years old. I've said this before in other interviews. My mother gave me a typewriter when I was 10, presumably to get her out of or to get me out of her hair on a Saturday afternoon. And I started typing up stories about, you know, superheroes and monsters and things like that. And I never stopped. As far as being a published author, the idea that that could ever actually happen never really crossed my mind in any kind of serious way until I became engaged to my wife, who was my encouragement, you know, to go ahead and self-publish. And the idea was, if I could self-publish and it was good enough, if it turned out to be good enough, then somebody would take notice of that and, you know, offer me a contract, and then I could be, you know, get out of that the stigma of the self-publication thing. And if it wasn't good enough, well, then it wasn't good enough. You know, I was always willing to let my work stand or fall on its own merit, and it wasn't going to be brokenhearted one way or another. The big thing, I think, for people who want to be published or who are aspiring writers is that you have to do it because you love it and for no other reason, because if you have some kind of ulterior motive or in the back of your mind you think you're going to make it big someday, you know, that's probably not going to happen. So you need to do it because you do it whether you made a nickel off of it or not. That's the way I always approached it. And it just happened to turn out that my gambit of getting itself publicly, the book self-published, and then someone taking notice paid off for me. So I was very lucky in that regard.
And how did that work? I know that you're published now by Permuted Press, but so you self-published and then they discovered the novel? Is that how it worked?
Right. Yeah, I self-published through a company called iUniverse in 2003. That was when Autobiography of a Werewolf Hunter was then known as When the Autumn Moon is Bright. And then it was subtitled Autobiography of a Werewolf Hunter. Right. I self-published that one, and I entered it in the Independent Publisher Awards contest, and it won. It placed what was the equivalent of a silver medal in that contest, which gave me great encouragement for something like that, to have, you know, the work validated by someone other than, you know, people who basically have to like it because they're your friends and family.
Right.
And so that's what I did, and I also self-published Heart of Scars as a sequel. And then Jacob from Permuted Press, I'm not sure exactly how he found the novels, but I got an email from him one day saying, hey, this is my name, this is the company that I've got, and we're interested in picking you up. And I've been skeptical about that, these kinds of things, because, you know, there's always somebody wanting to make a buck off your back. But I did the due diligence on that, and it's a great, Permuted Press is a great outfit. I was very lucky to be picked up by them.
That's great. That's great. So, the book that you, self-published, Autobiography of Werewolf Hunter, was that the first novel that you had written, or were there other, you know, quote unquote, kind of practice novels to learn the craft?
Yeah, I've got... Like I said, I never stopped writing, and I never threw anything away either. So what I've got now, somewhere in the annals of my library here, I've got six thick three-ring binders full of manuscripts. They're not actually manuscripts. They're done on a typewriter, which is how I used to write up until around 2000, when I finally was brought into the computer age kicking and screaming. But I have six other manuscripts, totally, a lot of them completely unrelated to the material that's out there now. And the idea was that when I rewrote Autobiography of a Werewolf Hunter, was to take all that material and compile it into one book. And it didn't work out that way at all. And so now I have six, you know, completely unrelated binders full of supplemental material, which sometimes follows and sometimes doesn't follow the chronology of the books. But yeah, that was a lot of practice or good test runs for me there because, like I said, it was all done on computer. And so I remember, you know, making a mistake and running out of correction ribbon and having to run to Walmart, you know, at 2 a.m. and pick up some correction ribbon, get back to the house so I could, you know, go to sleep that night knowing that I had done my best for the day.
Right, right. And what kept you going doing that?
You know, it's a vision for the character. That's all I know how to say it as. I have had a vision in my mind of Sylvester Logan James since probably 1986. I can about pinpoint it to then. I mean, he existed before that in various forms, but I really kind of got a feel for him around 86. And I can't shake it. I've tried to write even other things, and I can't do any more than just a couple of short stories at a time before I'm drawn back into the world of Sylvester. And I don't think I'm going to be able to write anything else until I'm done with his story. And I don't really know how to explain it other than it's just something that I have a real feel for in my heart. I know the guy. And if he was a real human being, I'd be scared shitless of him. But I feel like I know the guy because he's just been with me for so long.
Sure. And are you working on a third novel now? And do you have novels in your mind beyond that?
I am working on the third novel now. Originally, I had kind of planned this to be a trilogy, and that's kind of still where I'm at with it. I've been working on this last one for a couple of years now. Progress has been slowed considerably due to the birth of my son a couple years ago because I work slow anyway, and that didn't help matters. But yeah, we're coming along real good on that. I'm probably 2/3 of the way through, I would estimate, with The Lineage, which is what the third one is tentatively called. That should, in effect, wrap up the saga of Sylvester James. And then beyond that, I do have one thing I want to do before I take up anything else. I want to write a prequel, which should be pretty lengthy, I'm thinking, detailing the life of Sylvester's mentor in the books, Michael Winterfox, who's the old Cheyenne mystic that takes him in and teaches him some of the old skills of his almost extinct order of Cheyenne warriors.
Right. And given your success to date, what advice do you have for aspiring writers who may be listening who would like to get their own novels or short stories published one day?
Well, I think that the best advice that I could give I've already given, and that is, you know, if you love what you do, if you love to write, if you feel like you would do it no matter if you were doing it for free or not, then you're on the right track. And find something that you know about, but don't be afraid to write what you don't know about because you need to learn as well. A lot of people come from the place, you know, like every English teacher or literature teacher tells their kids, you know, write what you know. Well, that's true, you know, to start off with, but you also have to be willing to expand your horizons and learn new things because it's the only way you're going to grow as a writer. If you just write what you know, any one of us can probably fill a suitcase with what we know and then what, you know, you have to learn new things and constantly challenge yourself with detail, vocabulary, and just the poetry of writing. There's so many things I read nowadays that have no heart to it. You know, it's either, you know, very flowered up with this, you know, $50 words that nobody uses in real life. And I use my share of those. I'm not immune to this either. Or, you know, the dialogue is so stunted that a third grader could have written it. You know, just try to find a middle ground and make your voice, practice getting your voice heard until you're happy with it, because that's pretty much the only way, it's the only standard that you have. If I can read a page and I'm happy with it, then I have to let it go. I can't worry about, you know, well, is this going to offend this part of the population, or is somebody going to think that I'm too weak on this subject? You just you have to do what you do and let it go. And that, I think that's true no matter what you do. If you're a writer, painter, sculptor, if you do any kind of a creative thing at all, I think that holds true.
Sure. Do you have any specific kind of writing process or rituals that you go through?
Yeah, I do. And I think everybody does, but mine are pretty simple compared to some of the ones that I've heard about. I go through a period of, again, I work slowly, admittedly. So, but I'll go through a period of a year to 3 years sometimes doing nothing but accumulating ideas. And I'll write ideas down for sometimes, like I said, 1 to 3 years, and words or phrases or concepts that I appeal to me or catch my eye. And I'll let all that kind of get mossy in my head, and I keep adding to it. It's kind of like throwing compost in a pile, you know. You get that all, get it real, work it all up and get it real fertile. And then I know when the time comes. It's in a weird way, it's kind of like, you know, I guess it's kind of like giving birth, because you get all this stuff going and you're gestating it in your mind and it's germinating. And finally there comes a time where you just feel like, yes, now is the time. It's about to spill out of me, you know, and then I'll sit down and I'll start writing. And from there, it's anybody's guess. I've tried to do outlines and that helps me, you know, to some extent. But what I found is that my outlines go right out the window in about chapter two. And the stories pretty much tend to take on life of their own. The characters create their own dialogue. Not all the time. I mean, I get writer's block like everybody else, and I get stumped for a month or two and just dread getting back to the keyboard again because I don't know what to do. But, you know, you that's something you have to face as a writer. You work it out. You keep going. And that's kind of my process.
That's interesting. I think everybody has their own unique way of approaching the writing process. So it's good to hear how you do it. What writers or books, either fiction or nonfiction, have you read in the past year or two that made an impression on you and that you might recommend?
Well, I have to say, and I have to, you know, I know I say this quite a bit, I think, but Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy is hands down the chief of books, not of fictional novels that I've read in the last 10 years, maybe my whole life. If you're not familiar with it, it's Cormac McCarthy, of course, author of The Road, No Right. Country for Old Men. Blood Meridian is basically and widely considered his masterpiece. It's a Western, it's a Western horror, I consider it, because it's so graphically violent and yet poetic at the same time. And I've read this book probably, without exaggeration, I can say that I read or listened to this book about 20 times in the last 6 years or so, and I have no plans of not doing of stopping that, because I just can't get enough of it.
What is it about it that resonates with you, or that you know?
Well, one of the things that I really relate to about it is that it's very close to the kind of things that I write about, and that is a theme of justification or redemption through violence. The characters in the story, although it's a Western, are basically trying to find their way in the world and weave order out of chaos through nothing else than, you know, wanton cruelty. And they're trying to force their way through it, you know, the violence. And, you know, in the books, in my books, Sylvester James is the same way. He basically has no recourse at a certain point but to try to find some kind of reason for his life through bloodshed. And there's no turning back to it. So the bloodshed just has to keep coming, and it gets deeper and deeper. The poetry of Blood Meridian is the other thing. How a book can be so wildly violent and yet so beautifully poetic at the same time is a paradox. It's one for the books. Cormac McCarthy, especially in this one, has just got a way of presenting a severed head on a china platter. It's just an elegantly brutal masterpiece. And it's the language, you know, it's the settings. And I'm a fan of the Old West from way back. I grew up watching spaghetti westerns and creature feature, you know. And so the Western horror connection is very deep, runs very deep in my blood. And Cormac McCarthy brings that together so well in Blood Meridian. And I know a lot of people have commented that about the book that they just couldn't finish it because it was so gruesome. But they're not obviously not horror fans. So,
gotcha. So where can people find you online?
I have a website that I use called werewolfhunter.com, and information on my books are there, as well as links to my Facebook page, which is where I interact with my readers on a pretty regular basis. I'll post snippets from the new books that I'm working on, information about interviews that I've done. In fact, whenever this comes out, I'll have a link to it there. But yeah, werewolfhunter.com is the best place to start, and you can find my books through links there on Amazon, and like I said, also my Facebook page.
Sure. Well, great. Well, again, we've been speaking with Brian Easton, author of Autobiography of a Werewolf Hunter and Heart of Scars, the second book in the Autobiography of a Werewolf Hunter. Both books, as he just said, are available online and in bookstores. Brian, thanks for doing this podcast.
It's my pleasure, Jeff. Thanks a lot.
Sure.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.